Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington, working on this program very remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Friday, March 25, 2022. The Ethiopian government and rebels in the Tigray region have signed truce to allow humanitarian agencies to access parts of the country affected by conflict.
In part is in response to the growing calls by international community, especially the West, to allow humanitarian access to the Tigray region. It's also partly informed by the growing confidence of the Abiy Ahmed's government in its ability to contain the Tigray. They no longer see them as existential threat like they saw them just a couple months ago.
And the Intergovernmental Authority on Development prepares journalists to fight misinformation.
We have to look no further than Ukraine to see the dangerous influence of false information. Media strategies can help, but the trust and credibility of information providers is crucial.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Ethiopian government and rebels in the embattled Tigray region have declared a truce to allow humanitarian agencies to reach millions in need. Aid to the region has been limited for months due to the ongoing conflict and accusations that both sides are blocking roads. Some experts say humanitarian organizations may find it challenging to reach all people in the country's north. Muhammad Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
After months of little or no access to millions in need, humanitarian agencies will have a chance to distribute food, water and medicine in northern Ethiopia. Some aid organizations are still studying the government's statement on the ceasefire in the Tigray region to determine how much access they will have. In a statement to VOA, Oxfam International Country Director Gezahegn Gedebe-Kerbehena called on all warring parties to honor the truce and allow aid agencies unfettered access to the communities. However, Hassan Kananji, the head of the Horn Institute for Strategic Studies, does not believe the government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, will give aid groups a free hand. Both sides, he says, may fear exposing human rights abuses.
They may be afraid in certain instances that humanitarian organizations may have access to some of the evidence of the crimes that were committed during the war. And so I do not think they're going to have a free access to every part they want or to every human soul, you know, who's going to be in need. But they, to the extent that they have some access, I think that is something positive.
The Ethiopian government launched a military operation against the Tigray People's Liberation Front rebel group in November 2020. The 16-month-old conflict has claimed the lives of tens of thousands and displaced millions. The conflict spread to other parts of the country, and at one point, rebel groups threatened to march to the capital to topple Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government. Obang Metho, a social justice activist, welcomes the temporary halt to the conflict.
There are so many people who are suffering, in, not only in the Tigray region, but throughout Ethiopia, in Afar regions and then in Amhara regions. Those people definitely are needing an assistance. So the truce is not only between what's happening in the Tigray region alone. I think it's what's happening in Ethiopia. So for sure that I hope that it will lead to helping the suffering of the people.
Hananji says the pressure exerted on the Ethiopian government and the rebel groups has paid off.
In part is in response to the growing calls by international community, especially the West, to allow humanitarian access to the Tigray region. It's also partly informed by the growing confidence of the Abiy Ahmed's government in its ability to contain the Tigray. They no longer see them as an existential threat like they saw them just a couple months ago.
The aid groups estimate at least 9.4 million people in Ethiopia need urgent humanitarian aid after fleeing their farms and homes due to conflict. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, is working with journalists to develop strategies and best communication practices for reporting and countering misinformation campaigns by terrorist organizations. IGAD brought dozens of journalists in the region to Djibouti for a three-day forum aimed at building a community of professionals to keep the public informed of events across the region. Sheila Pony attended the three-day workshop in Djibouti and prepared this report. Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba.
Organizers of the forum say the fragility of many African states, especially in the East African region and their porous borders, are an incubator of violent extremist activity. To address the growing problem, the IGAD Center of Excellence for Preventing and Countering Violent Extremism, with funding from Denmark, the European Union and the United States, brought together 30 journalists from Djibouti, South Sudan, Sudan, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia and Uganda to exchange ideas and develop strategies on how to counter disinformation by extremist groups. Speaking at the start of the forum, U.S. Ambassador to Djibouti, Jonathan Pratt, told journalists they have a crucial role to play in countering disinformation put out by terrorist groups.
Through the stories you and your outlets select, you can show the negative impact of extremist false narratives, hate speech, and prejudice.
Ambassador Pratt stressed the timeliness of the IGAD conference with Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine.
We have to look no further than Ukraine to see the dangerous influence of false information. Current regional challenges posed by violent extremism have increased the need for an evidence-based understanding of how communities can respond to such threats. Media strategies can help, but the trust and credibility of information providers is crucial.
Throughout the 3 days, experts provided examples of tactics that violent groups use to spread disinformation on various media and social platforms. Some sessions were also designated to assist journalists and media practitioners develop checklists on accuracy and best practices. The European Union's ambassador to Djibouti, Aidan O'Hara, emphasized the transnational threat of violent extremism, which he says undermines the security and stability of nations and often puts journalists' lives in danger.
Violent extremism is everywhere. It's here in the Horn of Africa, and we're trying to cope with it in Europe too. I don't envy the role of the media in trying to navigate this issue. Journalists are often caught in the middle, under pressure from extremists to disseminate their poisonous messages, and attacked by the same people if they try to resist.
BBC journalist Hussein Muhammad, one of the trainers at the conference, says he witnessed firsthand the Al-Shabaab terrorist violence at Kenya's Garissa University in 2015 and at the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, Kenya in 2013.
The most important thing I'll tell you, there is no story worth your life. So if you feel that your risk assessment is telling you not to go that place, please don't go. Every country has its own solution, but we still have to follow the good tenets of journalism as Africans.
The IGAD Center of Excellence for Preventing and Countering Violent Extremism says timely information sharing and literacy training activities for social media are important tools for effectively preventing and countering violent extremism. To that end, organizers say a journalist and media practitioner checklist developed during the forum will be published and shared through the IGAD Center's communication platforms. For VOA News, I'm Charlton Doki in Juba.
The United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, is urging partners in the Transitional Government of National Unity to respect the revitalized peace agreement. The Special Representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan says he's concerned about the recent developments between South Sudan's peace partners, including clashes in Upper Nile and Unity States. Manyang David Mayer has more on the story.
In a press statement issued yesterday, UNMISS boss Nicholas Aysom said there is no military solution to the conflict in South Sudan. Habib Labidi, UNMISS public information officer, read excerpt from Aysom's statement to South Sudan in Focus today.
I encourage all political parties to put aside their differences in the larger interest of peace, progress, and prosperity. UNMISS stands ready to extend its full support in this regard.
Earlier this week, the SPLM in opposition announced it was pulling out of all meetings of the security mechanism of the peace agreement to protest what it called repeated attacks by the South Sudan People's Defense Force on its military base in Upper Nile and Unity States. Asom says the decision by the SPLM-IO to withdraw from the security mechanism meetings is, in his words, deeply worrying. But the top UN official in South Sudan says the concerns raised by the SPLM-IO are reasonable.
We can acknowledge some of the concerns raised by the SPLM-IO, especially the alarming spike in violent conflict in Upper Nile and Unity States that has directly impacted their cantonment sites as well as innocent civilians.
In a statement issued on Wednesday, the United States, the United Kingdom and Norway, referred to as the Troika, condemned the attack and called on the parties to recommit to implementing the peace agreement. ASOM says the reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the body tasked with tracking violations, has, quote, noted the concerns and consequential violence regarding ongoing defections among the ranks of the stakeholders, calling on all parties to comply fully with the letter and spirit of the peace agreement, end quote. In a statement released yesterday, the interim chairperson of the reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, Major General Charles Taigitwai, called on the South Sudanese peace partners to seek a peaceful solution to their differences, saying, quote, inclusive dialogue within the framework of the ACRIS is the only way of resolving disagreements, end quote. The 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement calls for conducting general elections in 2023, which will bring the Revitalized Transitional Government of National Unity to an end. With less than 12 months remaining, ASOM's statement read by Labidi call on the parties to remain on the track of peace.
Less than 12 months of the transitional period remain. It is crucial that all parties continue their best efforts to sustain the ceasefire and work towards implementing all outstanding benchmarks so that free and fair elections can take place.
The head of the United Nations mission in South Sudan says the mission continues to engage with communities and authorities in all volatile locations to prevent further escalation and to support humanitarian partners in delivering aid to the conflict affected. Elections are scheduled to be held in February 2023, but some South Sudanese lawmakers have said elections should be delayed if the key provisions in the peace deal are not implemented before then. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Bor.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, the World Health Organization is appealing for funds to fight preventable and curable diseases across the continent. Find out more after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you know any first aid techniques?
Come to think of this question, I thought I do, but seriously, I think I may not be able to do too well if there is any situation present. Maybe it's something I need to go in and learn how to do. It could help somebody tomorrow.
During our school days, the Red Cross Society, the clubs that we joined, they taught us a lot. When a child runs high temperature, you sponge the child with water from the leg to the head. Then you just rush the person to the hospital for best treatment.
In case if you have drowned maybe from water, the first aid technique that is available to be given is a kiss of life to a person that has drawn into water.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
In marking the World TB Day, the World Health Organization is calling for increased funding to fight tuberculosis, a preventable, curable disease, which kills and sickens millions of people every year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Health Organization warns the fight against tuberculosis is at a critical juncture. It says the COVID-19 pandemic has reversed gains made since 2000 in saving lives from the infectious disease. For the first time in over a decade, the WHO says TB deaths increased in 2020. It says around 1.5 million people died of TB during that pandemic year because of disruptions in services and lack of resources. Most deaths have occurred in developing countries, with conflict-affected countries across Eastern Europe, Africa, and the Middle East at greatest risk. The director of the WHO's Global Tuberculosis Program, Teresa Caseva, says an extra $1.1 billion a year is needed for the development of new tools, especially new vaccines, to achieve the goal of ending TB by 2030. She says investing in the fight against tuberculosis is a no-brainer, given the benefits gained for each dollar spent.
For every $1 invested to end TB, 43 is returned as the benefits of a healthier functioning society. Ending TB by 2030 can lead to avoiding 23.8 million tuberculosis deaths and almost $13 trillion in economic losses.
The WHO says extra funding would allow the world to treat 50 million people with TB, including 3.7 million children and 2.2 million with drug-resistant TB. WHO officials say that would be particularly beneficial for children and young adults who lag adults in accessing TB prevention and care. Team leader of vulnerable populations in the WHO Global TB Program, Carrie Vinney, says 1 million children and young adolescents become ill with tuberculosis every year.
Unfortunately, less than half of these children and adolescents are diagnosed or reported, which means that there is a large detection gap. In addition, in 2020, approximately 226,000 children died due to TB, and again, most of these children did not access TB care.
The WHO is issuing updated guidelines for the management of TB in children and adolescents for diagnosis, treatment, and prevention. Officials call the new recommendations a game changer. They say they will help that vulnerable group of young people get diagnosed and more quickly receive the life-saving care it needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move back to Africa, where thousands of adolescent girls across Africa drop out of school and face discrimination and exclusion from activities because of pregnancy. The African Committee of Experts on the Rights and Welfare of the Child under the African Union is reviewing compliance with the African Child Rights Treaty signed by the Republic of Congo, Eritrea, Seychelles, and Uganda. All these four countries are obliged under this treaty to protect girls' right to education and ensure that pregnant girls can stay in school. Maureen Odhiambo reports.
Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, teenage pregnancies have increased in various African countries. Many girls' futures are at stake, and a pan-African response is needed to save a generation. The African Committee of Experts on the Rights and Welfare of the Child must review how countries are treating students who are pregnant and establish whether their laws and policies hinder or protect the access to education. Senior children's rights researcher at Human Rights Watch, Ellen Martinez, says many girls are not able to continue with their education once they get pregnant in most African countries.
A lot of girls, and particularly those that got pregnant during the pandemic and are now adolescent mothers, are facing the same barriers that many thousands faced prior to the pandemic. So obviously the stigma and discrimination that a lot of girls face in their communities as a result of pregnancy. And rather than receiving support within their communities, many are isolated. Many are not provided with support to be able to go to school and engage in other learning and development activities.
Over 30 African governments have adopted measures that protect adolescent girls' rights to stay in school during pregnancy. However, Human Rights Watch has found that the levels of protection and implementation vary, and that some governments often lack clear guidelines on how these students may continue with their education, leading to irregular enforcement. A Kenyan, Elizabeth Wanjiru, has come up with a rescue center that is also a school for teenage girls in Nyeri, Kenya. Wanjiru, who was a teen mother, says it was the most difficult moment.
Again, I was not psychologically prepared to be a mother. I did not know what to do with this baby. There's a lot of stigma surrounding teenage motherhood. There's the whole aspect of this girl has gotten pregnant before she's married, and everybody thinks the girl was promiscuous.
In countries like Uganda, girls are required to go on mandatory maternity leave from school when they are at least 3 months pregnant. They are later allowed to resume schooling after 1 year, regardless of their personal situation. Wanjiru says, despite some governments having policies to keep pregnant girls in school, the responsibilities of motherhood force most of the girls to stay at home.
Most guardians lose hope and say, will I take her back to school, then she will give birth again. You know, it is not an issue of that they are chased out. Nobody chases them out of school. The circumstances that are there are the ones that make the girl just drop out of school.
Tanzania had been among countries in Africa that banned pregnant girls from continuing with education. But that has come to an end after authorities pledged to have adolescent mothers return to school by June this year. Human Rights Watch suggests that countries should take affirmative measures to guarantee the right to education for the students. I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
Cameroon says hospitals in the western border with Nigeria are overwhelmed by the number of cholera patients seeking help. Over the past 2 days, some 600 cholera patients have been admitted to the facility in three western towns. 12 of the patients have died, and authorities say the hospitals are at full capacity. Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's public health ministry says a cholera outbreak is sweeping across the towns of Limbe, Boya, and Tiko near the border with Nigeria. The government says 12 of the 600 patients rushed to hospitals in Limbe, Boya, and Tiko died within the past 72 hours. Nyenti Anereke is director of the Limbe Government Hospital. He says the Limbe Hospital that has a capacity of 200 beds has received more than 240 cholera patients.
We built three tents in Limbe Hospital yesterday because patients were at the veranda, at the corridors of the ward. All the beds were full. The Tiko District Hospital, the capacity also is overpowered. The hospital in Bota is another crisis zone.
To cope with the overflow, humanitarian workers are helping to erect tents at the hospitals in Limbe and Boya. Still, the government says many families are rushing their sick relatives to surrounding towns, including Motengane and Douala, a commercial hub on the Atlantic coast. Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of the southwest region where Limbe, Tiko, and Boya are located, chaired at least three crisis meetings on Wednesday. Bilai says the cholera outbreak is caused by a shortage of clean drinking water in western towns and villages, provoked by the long dry season. Bilai says civilians should desist from drinking open stream water. He says the disease is spreading fast because cattle and civilians defecate in the open and in rivers.
The cholera outbreak is there. Our structures, the hospitals, are overloaded. But thank God that the medical officers in charge of those hospitals have been proactive and they have taken measures to receive various patients. All the patients are under treatment.
Bilai said the government will provide water to arid towns like Limbe, Boya, and Tiko, and surrounding villages, but did not say when. Meanwhile, health officials are moving from door to door, encouraging civilians to boil water from wells and streams before drinking it. The government says people should also eat only properly cooked food and wash their hands before and after meals and after using the bathroom. Another cholera outbreak in Cameroon in February affected 1,300 people and killed about 36. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
We love to hear your comments on issues in this broadcast. My colleague Nabil Biagio is ready with this week's listener comments. Over to you, Nabil.
Thank you, John. We heard from many of you this week about our coverage of recent clashes between the SSPDF and the SPLA-IO forces, such as Isaac Men Matiang in Juba, who writes, "I am requesting that both the SSPDF and the SPLA-IO respect the spirit of the peace agreement, which the citizens hope to be prioritized because we need to focus on issues of development rather than investing much of our resources in war. We are also tired of the many road attacks and insecurity in our country." Pam Bilodeng Luat from the IDP camp in Juba says, Hello, VOA John Tanza and Nabil Biagio. I am greatly impressed with the South Sudan in focus. My message to South Sudanese is that let the parties who are signatories to the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement respect the interests of the nation at large, not the parties' interests in a peace agreement. For the SPLM-IO to fall out from peace talks would mark the start of fading peace in the nation. My call goes to the peace partners in South Sudan, such as IGAD, the Troika, UN Peacekeepers, the AU and European Union, to put pressure on the parties to fully commit to the implementation of the peace deal. The collapse of the peace agreement will result negatively on all sides of the country. Thanks. Samuel Ramon in Yale writes, Hi, John Tanza and Nabil Biagio. I wish I was among the country's parliamentarians. I would have impeached the peace violators in the state. Garkwath Manong Chuang Kujik from Juba's Protection of Civilians Camp 1 says, Hello, John Tanza and Nabil. I am really concerned about the pullout of the SPLA-IO representatives from the RJMAC meetings, because if the SPLA-IO continues to not attend, it will lead to a fragile axis, which will fuel bloodshed in the country. I want peace facilitators in the SPLA-IO under Dr. Riek Machar and under the president to table once again and put sanctions on defectors from both warring parties, because they are the people who are against peace implementation in South Sudan. Ustaz Jemis Gadlong Riak, who identifies himself as an IDP in Juba, writes, Dear VOA, I appreciate your weekly updating about South Sudan news. The pullout of the SPLA-IO is not surprising. Who would not do that? RJMAC or CITESAM VM? We are tired of their words without any action. May God help South Sudan. John from Juba says the rejection of the SPLM-IO nominee for governorship in Upper Nile was a clear indication that President Kiir is not for peace. Now Machar has just realized that from the attack by SSPDF. God will one day answer our prayers and punish those who do not want peace in the country. Peter Goj Anyang Majongdul in Block 3 of Bortown writes, I hope the visit by the SSPDF to Rwanda will bring significant change and transformation of the SSPDF and make a national army rather than a tribal army. Someone from Bantu Town in Unity State who did not leave their name says, Nabil and John Tanza, South Sudanese warring parties are returning to full-scale war while citizens are in need of peace implementation. We need peace, not war. The country needs development services to be delivered to the people of South Sudan. Joel Philip Kwan in Bortown of Jongole State writes, Hello, VOA News. I urge both Riek Machar, First Vice President of the Republic of South Sudan, and President Salva Kiir to look back on the Revitalized Peace Agreement, which was signed in 2018 by the SPLM in government and the SPLM in opposition, and should respect the agreement in spirit and paper. These two leaders should not let the people of South Sudan go back to war. Tell them we're tired of wars. Bida Bukuli says, Hi, John Tanza. Thanks for the show. We need our leaders to see what is happening in South Sudan and act accordingly, not listen to neighboring country leaders who are causing the war to continue. We appreciate hearing from so many of you. A reminder that the views expressed here do not reflect the views of VOA or of this program. Keep those comments coming.
Keep your comments brief and we will sample some of your remarks every Friday. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. That's all we prepared for you this Friday. We now end this show with the song Aisha by Khalid. Listening to Khalid and the song Aisha. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking time to be with us this evening. Remember to join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.